Hey, and welcome back to the A24 podcast. Friends and theater legends Patti LuPone and Nathan Lane met over 40 years ago while acting off-Broadway, and their careers converged once again this past year when they both starred in Ari Aster's Beau is Afraid. For today's episode, we got Patti and Nathan together to talk about the state of showbiz, being players in the A24 repertoire, and Nathan's latest role in Dix the Musical. We hope you enjoy the conversation. Catch Nathan and Dix when it opens nationwide this weekend.
Hi, everyone. This is Nathan Lane.
And I'm Patti LuPone.
And we're just going to sit around for an hour and bitch.
All for A24.
A24.
Our new home. Ready, steady, go. Nathan, we met doing that Albert Inarritu play. I can't remember the name of it. In 1984.
Yes.
At the Public Theater.
What was it? Something Coming of Age in Soho?
I don't know.
That was the name of it.
Coming of Age in Soho.
And it was about 4 hours.
I do remember that we would go back to my apartment and have parties.
Well, we did the reading. We did go back to you had a townhouse, right?
Duplex on 20th Street.
Okay. Well, we went back there, you and I, and there was a younger actor, Matt. I've seen him, but he was attractive. And then there was some herbal inspiration. And then I realized maybe it was time for me to go. That's what I recall. The reading seemed to take up most of our adult lives. It was endless. So yeah. When we went out of there, it was like we had escaped something. And I think everyone was ready to let loose a bit.
Who directed it? Who directed the reading?
That's a good question. Was it Peter Mark Shifter? Remember him? Did he do it? Because he worked with Albert often. He directed Gemini, didn't he?
I don't think it could have been because he was in my first class with me at Juilliard.
Wow.
Peter Shifter. And he was not a good actor at all.
No.
And I don't think he lasted beyond the first year, but he was also bizarre.
Well,
he was so strange.
And when bizarre non-actors have nothing to do, they become directors.
I think you're right. We had a lot of crazy people. John Houseman looked for the 36 of the craziest people he could find. Peter was one of them.
What was John Houseman like?
He was exactly
like what you saw on television and film?
In Paper Chase. He was frightening to me. Actually, this is a famous story. I think I've told it a million times. We go down, we're in the new building now, and I get into the elevator, and it's an elevator filled with people and Mr. Houseman. I never called him John because he was so intimidating. I said, hello, Mr. Houseman. And he turned around and said, Louise Bernicau says you're the most illiterate person she's ever met. It was so humiliating. I couldn't answer. I mean, I think I said probably. Yeah.
Wow.
I was so shocked and humiliated in a room full of, in an elevator full of musicians. So I was the only actor in that and Mr. Houseman.
Aside from being unpleasant, are those people, do you think they're trying to test you in some way? That way of seeing what you're made of by saying something rude.
They totally tested us. It was a brutal experience. What about you? Did you go to an acting school?
No, I didn't go to an acting school.
Did you go to a comedy school? Did you go to clown school?
That seems clear. When I was a kid, I mean, very young, I went to the Stella Adler Studios.
Oh, right.
And I took like a crash course. I took acting, movement, and speech. I studied not with Stella Adler, but with her cousin Pearl. It was like Pearl Pearlstein or something like that. And she was not quite as theatrical as Stella, but just pretentious enough. And so we were doing this acting class. This is a story I've told many times. And it was all rather abstract to me. I had already been working as an actor. So, and when I decided I better go study this a little. And so we were having this class and she wanted, it was, I don't know, sense memory or something. She said, everybody go to the windows and look out and take it all in. And then you come back and tell me what you see. And a young lady said, oh, I saw in the clouds, I could see my grandmother's face, who I lost when I was very young. And a guy said, oh, I saw a man, an old man walking his dog, and it was heartbreaking. And it reminded me of something in my own life and how I should reach out to my grandparents. And then she said, Mr. Lane, what did you see? And I said, I see $400 going down the drain.
Did you get thrown out of the class, or did you say, now that's the answer I'm looking for?
I think I got a laugh, but I wasn't quite ready for that.
Do you know, the only acting classes I went to was Juilliard, but just recently, Nathan, it's been on my bookshelf forever. I picked it up. It's The Fervent Years by Harold Clurman. Harold were married. Great book. Now I wish that I had experienced Stella Adler because of the group theater.
Well, there's a great American Masters documentary about her. She's, you can see her on YouTube now, like as you can see everything. You know, they were married, she and Harold Clurman. There's some story about one night they were in bed and Harold kept tossing and turning and she woke him up and she said, "Harold, stop sleeping like a great man." Anyway, so yes, I wish I had studied with her. I did eventually, I took some classes with an acting teacher named Joan Bellamo, which were very helpful to me. And then the rest is just from experience, just learning on the job experience and watching other actors that I admired.
Nathan, was Joan Bellamo independent of Stella Adler? Was she independent of the Actors Studio, independent of the Stanislavski technique?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I mean, yes. It was
the reason I ask is because knowing nothing about the Stanislavski technique, I denigrated it, going, I'm not a method actor. Turns out I'm a method actor. Turns out what I know about method now is I am completely a method actor. Just sense memory. You know what I mean? Sometimes at a school, we weren't taught method. We had our acting training the first year. They had no clue. And they hired actors who would teach us what they knew until I got a job and left. And then the next person would come in and go, well, what he said was nonsense. This is the thing. We learned how to act by default. And we learned, because we didn't have a solid acting technique, that every technique, any technique works.
Yeah, you gather a bit from each one. You know, I read all their books, Uta Hagen, Respect for Acting, and Sandy Meisner, and Robert Lewis, and have you read the book by Isaac Butler, The Method? You know that book?
No.
How the 20th Century Learned to Act? Oh, it's fabulous. It would make a great miniseries because it starts in the Moscow Art Theater and Stanislavski and the guy who, I can't remember all the names, but the guy who was running the place and bringing in Stanislavski and how that all started and him wanting to do after the Seagull had failed and then wanting to revive it there and all of the work he put into it. And Chekhov was very nervous because he was putting in all these sounds of birds tweeting and getting in the way. And then it was hailed as a masterpiece. And
what's the name of the book?
It's called The Method, How the 20th Century Learned to Act by Isaac Butler. He co-wrote the oral history of Angels in America. Wonderful writer. And this book was just staggering. And then it's all about how a lot of those people, Maria Ospenskaya, Richard Boleslavsky, when they all came over and they started teaching in America. You know how we call sections of a scene the beats of a scene? Well, it came about because they were all Russian and they used to call them the bits, but they talked like the beats. So that's why people call them beats. So then it's about that whole history and then the group theater and how they all started to spread out and start their, you know, everybody had their version of it. And Stella, you know, went over and met with Stanislavski. And then in the book, in this particular book, they have sections from Stanislavski's diary where he talks about how annoying Stella Adler is. She asked too many questions.
Speaking of the group theater, if I'm interpreting this book correctly, they formed the group theater where Harold Clurman wanted to create a different theater as a reaction to what was on Broadway, which was Gaiety. Right. And don't you find we're sort of in the same situation now with what is on Broadway? I see what's on Broadway and I think it's a circus, it's Disneyland, and it's Las Vegas. And I wonder if we have enough gumption or there are creators out there that are reacting to this theater on Broadway now to create a new theater. I've said, I don't want to be on Broadway anymore. I want to be in a storefront. I want to create theater. I don't want to be in this particular theater.
Right. It's changed.
And I just, it's changed. And I'm just wondering whether there'll be support for it, financial support for it, and there'll be creators that will shift it once again.
Yeah. I don't know whether we're raising a generation that would be interested in that.
Exactly right.
There was a time when I went into this, I didn't go to a school, but I wanted to read everything there was about the history of the theater, the people who started it, going back to the Greeks, the Elizabethans, all the way through. I wanted to know everything. I wanted to read about the different directors and writers. When I was a kid, I was always fascinated by the Algonquin Round Table, all these witty alcoholics. That's what I wanted. I wanted to go to the Algonquin and hang out with Dorothy Parker and Robert Benchley. My whole fantasy world of New York City and what it was like. And these people who are all writers and directors and actors and the Lunts, of course. You know, just the history of the Lunts. You know, these people now, you mention these names to kids, they don't know who they are. They don't know. You know, Zoe Caldwell died and people don't remember. That's why, so say, for example, Jack O'Brien has written now two books. But the first book, Jack Be Nimble, which was about the regional theater movement of which he was a part under the tutelage of Ellis Rabb. But Jack's description of a young Rosemary Harris walking on stage in some restoration play, how she made her way down the stairs and picking up some object and whatever piece of business she had to do with it or a fan or something. And it was so vivid. It was like seeing a video of it. I mean, that's how we exist. We exist in people's memories. We see it and it's there and then it's gone. The notion of wanting to know that, whereas, you know, people now, it's about I'm a social media influencer. I'm on TikTok. You know, people are being discovered that way, getting instant celebrity, so-called celebrity. You know, those people haven't put in the work.
Yeah, exactly.
Other than recording videos.
That's what's so annoying about today's young actors. They do not want to put in the work. And part of the experience of acting is the work, is putting in the work to figure out how you do this, to strengthen the muscle. And it's shocking to me that, well, I saw it years ago. You know, I went back to school to talk to the graduating class. Our class, well, we were trained for the stage. We were not trained to go to Hollywood.
Right.
And
right.
The subsequent classes, and of course, it's 51 years ago. My first class was 1968, 68 to 72. We were trained for the stage. I never thought about going to Hollywood. I thought about dedicating my life, which I did, to the stage. And now it's all about fame, and it's not putting in the work. I think, to your point, the audience will find you. I've been saying forever, whoever's idea it was to dumb down America has done a brilliant job. I mean, you see it in the theater, you see it in our politics. We're stupid as shit. It's crazy. But I also think there are people, and there's a lot of people out there that want to be educated. They want to be moved. They want a transcendent experience in the theater. And it's about finding the place to create that and have the audience find you. I mean, that's kind of my desire now. I don't want to negotiate Times Square to get to the theater.
Right. The difficulty also is there's no one has any attention span anymore. No, everyone is on their phones. You know, when you're doing a movie or TV show and they yell cut and you see 25 people pick up a phone and stare at it. So we're losing the human connection. And that's really what the theater is about, a community experience. And, you know, the expense of it all now. A ton of money and to see somebody recreate a movie from the 80s. It's just like, well, why don't you just stay home and watch the movie? And
which is better.
Which is, you know, it once was affordable and it was, you know, with the work of Tennessee Williams and Arthur Miller, it was for everyone. It was somewhere where everyone could go. And it was about the human condition, what we're all going through. And now more often that's what you're finding on television. That's sort of where the best writing is turning up. I mean, there's, you know, small independent films of which we've been a part at A24.
And very proudly.
Very proud.
And I hope that we become repertory players in the A24 repertoire.
Absolutely.
Just putting it out there to A24 executives.
Yeah, exactly. You know, so it's very difficult, not unlike Broadway, which has been turned into a shopping mall. You know, now it's all in film. It's all about superheroes. Yeah.
Can I stop for a second? Because I want to ask you since we're on to A24, what it was like filming a musical. And if you can talk about it.
Sure, I can talk about. Dick's
how you felt. Yes, Dick's the musical. How you sang, how they filmed it. I'm really curious about that.
I came out of retirement to do a movie musical with Larry Charles. The wonderful Larry Charles directed this. It was a script originally titled Fucking Identical Twins. That was the name of when it was a sketch at Upright Citizens Brigade, when these two young guys, Josh Sharp and Aaron Jackson, did it in the basement of a Gristini's. And it was a huge success for them. And then they did it in LA. And then it was picked up first by 20th Century Fox. I don't know what they were thinking. And then eventually Peter Chernin Entertainment and A24 picked it up. You know, it's a satirical, absurdist, R-rated, queer musical about toxic masculinity and the Parent Trap. It's the plot of the Parent Trap. Josh and Aaron play two corporate businessmen, two macho guys who talk a lot about their dicks and being successful with women. And they work in a company together and they realize that they are identical twins, even though they don't look alike at all. They're both kind of lonely and they decide to reunite their parents and try to create a family again. And so I play their father, who is now, he's come out of the closet. He's gay. And he lives in an apartment with these two creatures he found in the sewer, which he calls the sewer boys. They're sort of like rescue dogs to him. And he feeds them he feeds them deli meat. He chews it up, spits it into their mouths. And they live in a cage in my living room. And the mother, played by the great Megan Mullally, is in a wheelchair and she's a shut-in. And she's quite eccentric. And years ago on a trip to Greece, you'll pardon the expression, she says her pussy fell off. But her son, it crawled away and her son hit it with a flip-flop. So they kept it and she keeps it in a baggie in her purse. So she still feels like a woman. Anyway, so that's sort of where we are. And when I read this, I laughed, but I thought, oh, this is, I don't know if I can do this stuff. And then I had a Zoom with Larry Charles, who has, you know, directed Borat. And, you know, I just loved him. And I thought he'll know how to do this. And then, of course, I had a dinner with these two guys, Josh and Aaron, and that went on for 4 hours. And I fell in love with them. And so I said, well, why not? What I admired was their chutzpah, the audacity of it all, because it's incredibly outrageous. And it's a musical. There are musical numbers they wrote with this composer, Carl St. Lucy. Numbers are terrific. They're tuneful and filthy. And, you know, we're in this climate right now where it's books are being banned. Don't say gay. Don't do this. You better be careful what you do in your comedy. And they come from this generation of young queer comedians like Julio Torres and Bowen Yang, who plays God in the film, Billy Eichner. They don't have that. They're not concerned with what you think.
Oh, yay.
You know, and when I've seen it now, I've seen like a few screenings and, you know, people just laugh their heads off. And there's something very freeing about it because of that. If whether you're, you know, obviously the target audience is the gay audience, but you know, it's deeply silly and outrageous, and I think really works because it's a musical. So this was a movie, you know, we made it in Burbank, and there were, I think they were studios, or it could have been a trucking company that just garages. You know, it was a very low budget, $12 million film, so everything is sort of handmade. Quality to it all. And we made it and sequenced then. So it was for me going back to, you know, singing, and it was nerve wracking. I mean, it was all pre-recorded, but you know, you're singing, you know, live in the moment when they're filming. But and you didn't really have time to think about it too much because you were like, they would spend one day and you would shoot an entire number. It ordinarily in a regular movie musical would have taken a week. But that was part of the kind of style of this piece. It was to make it feel like you were back in the basement of Gristini's. seeing these people put on a show. So it was, turned out to, I mean, we laughed ourselves silly. We had a great time. And then there's also, there's a Megan Thee Stallion. I don't know if you're familiar with her, the rapper.
I am. Yes, yeah? I am.
She plays their boss and she's phenomenal. She came in, she had 2 days. She did this whole, it's incredible. She's fabulous. So it turned out to be a lot of fun.
Did Larry understand how to shoot a musical on camera? I don't know what the context of the songs are, but.
Well, no, Stanley Donen, he's not. But, you know, he had a great DP and she was, you know, it was very straightforward. Nothing fancy, no Busby Berkeley overhead shot. Maybe one. I think there was maybe one overhead shot. But it was all very straightforward. And because there wasn't any time, I would make a suggestion and say, well, what if this happened or or that happened? And he would say, that's a great idea, but we don't have the money. Don't have the money or the time. And that became a part of, I think, the tone and the style of it all. But from what I've seen with audiences, it's working.
Where's it going to be released? Is it going to be released in theaters? Is it on Netflix?
Yes, in theaters. It opens today in select cities. And then it opens wide on the 20th.
Congratulations, Nathan.
Thank you. I mean, it did, you know, it was very a big hit at the Toronto Film Festival. And, you know, these screenings have gone well. Now it enters, you know, the real world where people are sitting at home just waiting to be offended. So, you know, that could spell trouble. I have no idea what will happen now, but it's a great deal of fun if you're open-minded.
Well, don't you think, speaking of that, don't you think at some point, and I hope it's today, the pendulum swings back with a vengeance?
Well, yes, the pendulum. Yes, it usually does. But this pendulum is very slow.
Yeah. It feels like they're like stuck on the other side.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
But it brings me back to what I said earlier. Whoever decided, the corporations, the government, whoever decided to dumb down the population of America has done a fucking brilliant job at it. I have PTSD for the last, I was at 8 years. I have a finite amount of time left. I have no idea how long I have left, but I'm on the other side of it. And I want to go someplace where I wake up in the morning and, oh, I see a blue sky. Oh, I see a red rose. Oh, I see green ferns, you know, with nothing interfering with that. And then I thought, okay, so I find my serenity. Am I going to have PTSD because I don't have PTSD anymore? You know what I mean? We grew up in this country with this stress.
Yeah.
Right. I have to tell you this. So my friend is Jake Heggie, who had his Met premiere.
I just saw it.
You saw Dead Man Walking?
Yo, what a gorgeous production.
Were you there on opening night?
Not opening night, but, there was a thing, it was sort of a reception afterwards. Tom Curtihy, Terrence's husband, put together. I mean, I just loved the production. It was so moving. And Joyce DiDonato and the actor.
Susan Graham and Ryan McKinney.
Well, one. Yeah. I mean, but, it was very moving. Sister Helen Prejean was there as well.
So I just read that Joyce DiDonato and Ryan McKinney either have done this, or I think they have done it. They went to Sing Sing with this.
Yeah.
And they incorporated
and the
inmates.
Played the chorus. Yes. Amazing.
Oh my God. And one of the prisoners said, I could cry. I feel alive. When I'm singing, I feel alive. I thought, oh my God, I just have to be reassured that there is humanity left in this world and in this country. I'm so messed up, so emotionally, mentally messed up about what's going on. I can't get a grasp on anything. Then you read something like that, and I have an explosion of emotion because it's an anomaly in our country right now. And it's, but to read, and then I start to think, why can't we do what the Norwegians do and have in their prison systems, have it be a rehabilitation prison? I witnessed this, the opera going there and having they're lifers. Those guys aren't getting out.
Yeah.
So they're lifers. And so to give them one shred of hope, feeling human again, is incredible.
Yeah. No, incredibly moving story, especially that particular story. And it was incredibly moving as well because it was Terrence McNally's debut.
Yeah.
The man, and that,
oh my God, that's of course, yeah.
Would have meant the world to him. being such an opera lover, you know, that really got me. No would have been more tickled than Terrence to be seeing that happening on the Met stage.
P.S. One more thing about that is it was the gala. So I'm sitting at a table and I just said to Neil Patrick Harris, I went, you cannot convince me that wasn't a real needle in the execution. I said, you cannot convince me. He said, no, that's we've all had them, those fake needles. I said, you can't convince me. Because they had a close-up of, Ivo Van Hove. Yeah. They had a close-up. So when Jake came over, and I said, so we got two questions. Was the silence in the execution, is that orchestrated? Is that you? Is that composed? He said, yes. And I said, is it a real needle? He said, yes. That's a real needle going into Ryan McKinney. Yes.
It's not like a retractable.
And it must be a nurse. It must be a real nurse.
It has to be.
That's administering that whole execution part. Yeah.
I mean, also, I said to Joyce DiDonato, who's magnificent, and I said, how often do you have to do this? And she said, 7 more times. And I was like, wow, I wish I had that schedule.
That's right. Oh, I said, and plus, they only perform like once every 2 days, once every 3 days.
I said, if you were doing 8 shows a week, you'd sound like Elaine Stritch.
Speaking of Elaine Stritch, I'm turning into Elaine Stritch. I want to go see Here We Are, and I can't go to the opening. So I told Rick Miramontes, I said, I need some pomp.
Yeah.
I'm turning into Elaine. That story about Elaine would go up to the box office and go, where's my tickets?
She told me this. Did I tell you this?
No.
She said, that's a tough ticket or something. And she said, I don't pay for anything. She said, you don't think I'm going to pay for tickets now after all the years I've been in show business? I said, well, how do you work? She said, I go up to the box office around 10 to 8. I say, hi, it's Elaine Stritch. Just give me a single in the back. And I said, and they always hand over a ticket? She said, absolutely, except for one show. And I said, which one? And she said, Mama fucking Mia.
I do know I hate ABBA. I protest.
Hate ABBA? How can you hate
ABBA? Because they became famous in the rock and roll era. And I am a devotee of the band. So ABBA comes, it's the band, it's the Beatles, it's the Rolling Stones, it's Three Dog Night. It's rock and roll era. And it's ABBA. And I went, what are you kidding me? You've got to be kidding me. Dancing Queen, give me a break. So I have protested all of it.
Really?
I've never seen Mamma Mia. I've never seen any of the movies. Every time there's music on, their music's on, I turn it off just because I'm like a Swiftie, only for the band.
Now, apparently, there are concerts where there are holograms of ABBA.
Yes, I have to tell you, I saw the original hologram, and it was Roy Orbison and Maria Callas when they first started this thing. No, and the Roy Orbison, I went... First of all, they found a woman in Queens. Let's talk about that, Maria Callas. They found a woman in Queens who looked like her. They rehearsed her for Maria's movements. And then they filmed her for the hologram. But the Roy Orbison was real footage of him.
And then they just lip synced. The woman lip synced to Maria.
Yeah. But then for the Roy Orbison, this was crazy. Yeah. He came up through the trap. And the floor. And he went down through the trap in the floor. I'm going, where's he going? To hell?
Yeah.
Comes up.
And it was a hologram.
Yeah. And went down. But it was the most insane staging because he was like going into a hole.
Right. Round
that back to, he's dead, right? So what, are you going to hell? Shouldn't he have like flown someplace? Shouldn't he have gone off stage left? It was so nuts.
After we're gone, there'll be holograms of you and me doing Anything Goes or something.
Or this. To a hologram of it.
Exactly.
I have to tell you about my son's podcast. So during lockdown, we were all together in Connecticut and he was so frustrated because he's a white boy in his 30s, anathema in our business right now. And I said, Josh, you have to create your own work, trying to help him out, what he did to create his own work was he took American short stories, dramatized them, and then asked American actors to read them as if they were plays. And it's called Radio Play Revival.
Oh.
And it's as if it's an old radio play, before TV, before.
Yeah.
You can pick it up from any podcast. And it's all, it's American literature that's in the public domain or that we've gotten permission from playwrights that are living. And we got these actors that we started in pandemic. and we're ending it in a strike.
Right.
So everybody was available and everybody said yes. And it was quite a journey for him.
It's like the old Lux Radio Theater.
Yeah.
Clifton Webb in Present Laughter.
Yes. And you know what? We should do more of that. Just to reintroduce Americans to our art. So I keep saying, I'm so saddened by the fact that when was the last time you heard the word art and culture in daily discourse in our country, in our politicians? And perhaps you were involved, but when Colleen Dewhurst was alive and they were doing the first National Endowment for the Arts cut, she asked a bunch of us to go down to Washington, D.C.
Right.
And the thing for the subcommittee, you know, should we cut the National Endowment for the Arts? And I kept hearing from these politicians, low priority, low priority, low priority. When for me, art is the soul of a nation.
Right.
And when have we ever been celebrated? When have we ever been acknowledged, let alone celebrated?
Yeah.
I just looked at the MacArthur Grant. Who even knows about the MacArthur Grant?
Yeah.
I looked at the recipients of the MacArthur Grant going, it's so out of the realm of discourse in this country. And it shouldn't be.
Well, it's always the first thing to go, or the arts.
And it's a human right.
Yes, totally.
It's a human right.
You know, it's proven how the arts are important to the young folks, people growing up, creating healthy, well-rounded human beings, music and art and dance and opera and plays and musicals. It's all incredibly important. Next month, they're doing a concert version of The Frogs.
Right, yeah.
Which I had done a revision of the libretto, and we did at Lincoln Center back in 2004. And so I've been, condensing it for the concert. And we had done a recording of this concert version of The Frogs we had done for Steve's 70th birthday at the Library of Congress. And it was, I just found it so moving, especially after 9/11, the notion of this, the god Dionysus feeling like the arts can affect change in society, that he has to go to Hades to bring back a great writer to speak to our nation and inspire it again. It's a very romantic, idealized notion, but it's incredibly important.
Incredibly important. That's why I love Ireland. Their heroes are poets and novelists.
Yeah.
And they sing. And
I'm looking into getting my Irish citizenship now. Both my grandparents were from Ireland, and because, you know, just in case.
Me too. I have my Italian citizenship. I did it because of the first Iraq war. My kid was draft age, and I went, he's not fighting in this war. There's no war he is going to fight in. And so I hired a genealogist to find out if one of my grandparents had done the right thing. And we went to my grandpa Patty first because he was murdered in Jamestown. We figured, oh, he didn't have time to naturalize. They can't find him in Sicily. They just can't find him in Sicily.
Well, he was
murdered? Murdered, yeah.
How?
Well, as I understand it, and it's written up in the Dunkirk paper, there was a knock on the door at 5 o'clock in the morning, which my grandmother answered. And there were a couple of guys out there and said, we want to speak to whatever his name was. I don't even know what my grandfather's name was. Shot him in the back of the head.
Wow.
And my grandmother and my mother and my Uncle George, and so fucking cliche, a Calabrese, were taken to the Jamestown police station for interrogation. People think, members of my family think that my grandmother was involved. My grandmother was a bootlegger.
The plot thickens. So
my grandmother was a bootlegger. We, and in her house in Jamestown, we all vied for this sewing room off of the kitchen because it was like being back in a womb. It was so dark and it was a window seat and a sewing machine, whatever. Well, apparently the floorboards lifted up and that's where she hid the whiskey.
Wow.
So it was never solved. They found the gun. He was murdered. He's buried in Jamestown. So we went to my grandpa Lupone, who did the right thing. And he did not naturalize. Apparently, he didn't naturalize, so he was still considered an Italian citizen. So it was easy for me to get my passport, and then my blood got it, Joshua. So I have an EU passport, which I am so grateful for, just in case.
Yeah, I know. Politics. What are you doing now?
There is an advantage to being in our profession, I think, and having the desire to broaden our visions. If I didn't act, I would be a hobo. I'd just be a traveler.
A hobo?
Because a hobo, yeah, why not? I would be a hobo. I would rather see the world than do anything else. I enjoy going into other countries and assimilating into their culture to understand it. And I think that has a lot to do with the fact that as an actor, it is our job to open our eyes and see and accept.
Many Americans don't want to leave the country. They're not interested in what's going on in the rest of the world. It's terrible.
It is terrible because you see how fortunate this country is, how fortunate the citizens of this country are. And if they only traveled, they would have more gratitude to what we do have, what seems to be a right. Washing machines and dryers, dishwashers, 2 cars in the driveway, a house, if you have that.
Yeah, but I mean, a lot of people can't afford that, you know.
Well, not anymore, but it's just so, I mean, I'm grateful that I was born into this. I mean, I do believe that I was chosen for this because I started at 4 years old and fell in love with the audience and never looked back. So I always said it chose me. I've always said it chose me. You know, right now with the strike on, I finished something in Atlanta that I'm very proud of and just waiting to see what happens. I'm singing, I do the concert work and there's interest in plays, but I kind of want to stay off the stage for a while because I don't want to do 8 shows a week anymore. I gave it 50 years. It's enough.
I understand. Yeah. I think I have a few more left in me, but yeah, it gets harder and harder. And
there's no life. I'm built for it. You're built for it. We have the muscle to do it. It's not that's not the problem. The problem is the one day off.
Yeah, yeah.
We have no life. The life is on the stage. And like I said, I haven't got that much life left. So yeah. I want to be able to have, I'd rather do film where you stick 2 days off. And well, maybe exactly. A whole week off.
Exactly. Yeah, I know. Oh, yeah. And then, you know, you do these things, you know, like this play I did, Pictures from Home last season. And, you know, it's Bartlett Sher, it's Danny Burstein, Zoe Wanamaker. You know, I thought it was a beautiful play, very funny, very moving story about this son and his parents and this photographer, Larry Sultan. Photographed them over a period of a decade and wrote this, what became his masterwork. And he interviewed them. And it was a way of also, of, I think, him trying to figure out his father and the effect that's had on him and how it's affecting his family. And it just seemed very, I hate to use the word relatable, but you know, it's about parents and mortality. It seemed like something we all have to go through or are going through. And then it was totally dismissed by the critics. You know, when you go, you work, you know, 2 years or something, you do a few readings and you work on this thing and then it's over. You know, it really hurt business. It was so across the boards dismissive. And yet the audience, you know, it was a crowd pleaser. The audience seemed to love it. You could hear people sniffling. And I would say to Danny Burstein, well, we can't, they can't just be pretending to be nice for our sake. They obviously like this play. And it seems to be a very effective piece. And so it was very puzzling and disappointing when it was just really kind of beaten up. And I, you know, and what can you do? That's what they all decided. So it shortened its life. And so after that,
it's heartbreaking.
You kind of go, well, I don't know if I want to go through that again.
Yeah, exactly. You put all that work in. And David Mamet said he didn't care what the critics said as long as he knew the critics loved the theater. And I don't know whether that's the case. But let's figure something positive. I look forward to seeing you this summer at your Hampstead estate. Estate in the Hamptons.
Anytime. Yes. It's always fun out there with Scotty and the gang.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
P.S. We're here, so we should have dinner. We could walk to each other.
Oh, yeah. That's right. That would be lovely. I would love that. Yeah, I'm around now. So
me too.
Yeah, we should have, we should talk other than on a podcast and have a dinner.
Exactly. Yes. And well, thank you, A24, for putting Nathan and me together.
Yes, thank you.
It was great. It was really great, Nathan. Don't you think we covered a lot of topics?
We sure did.
Love you, doll.
Nice to talk. Love you, too.
Bye.
Thank you very much. All right. Take care.
Thanks for listening. The A24 podcast is produced by us, A24. Special thanks to our editor, Tom Wyatt, and Robot Repair, who composed our theme.